This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Confounding, exhilarating, and contagious. Emotions matter, and so does applying emotional intelligence. Welcome to Dan Hill's EQ Spotlight, the podcast where emotions rule. Whatever the topic, how do hearts and minds collide? Find out with your host, a college professor turned globe-trotting EQ entrepreneur. His mission? Each week, Dan joins prominent authors in decoding how emotions drive outcomes and make people tick. Now, on to the show.
37th episode of my podcast, Dan Hill's EQ Spotlight. The series appears here on the New Books Network, which has as its motto, sharing knowledge so people can thrive. Today's topic is a delicious one. It's our love and hate of sacred monsters. I'm joined by Charlotte Fox Weber. She is the author of Tell Me What You Want, a therapist and her clients explore our 12 deepest desires. The publisher is Atria Books. Charlotte is a psychotherapist and writer. She co-founded Examined Life and was the founding head of the School of Life Psychotherapy. She grew up in Connecticut, Paris, and now lives in London with her husband and two young children. Welcome to the show, Charlotte.
Thank you so much.
I'm looking forward to it. I'm sure this will be fascinating. So let's maybe give the obligatory summary of the book to get us going.
Okay, so my book is about the conflict of desire and how we often struggle to identify what it is we really want. And we work against ourselves in various ways. But we also play emotional versions of hide and seek, where we can run away from what it is we really want and then hope that somehow we'll get it. And then life disappoints and frustrates. And very often, therapy is a space for discovering something surprising and strange about a part of yourself, a kind of deception. And it will turn out to be the discovery of a longing. And I think desire really wakes us up to a sense of possibility and forward motion. But it's often incredibly disturbing to us as well to feel desire strongly.
Oh, I think what you've already said is fascinating. I love the reference to hide and seek. I can't tell you how many times I wish I could talk my friends, my fellow adults, into playing childlike games like that once again, because I found them so enjoyable.
But also, it's so straightforward when you're playing the game with a child and you know the rules. And there's joy in the discovery of the hiding space. And I think if adults could kind of admit that they're playing emotional versions, we could understand ourselves with more ease.
Oh, absolutely. So speaking of understanding things, I don't normally draw on the what I'll call the PR package that comes with a book. But in this case, something caught my eye there. It said the book is the new five love languages. And I went, I don't remember her talking about the five love languages in the book. So I better ask her what that is to make sure I'm not leaving something essential out of the picture.
I mean, I don't talk about the five love languages in the book myself, but I I identify the core longings that I think we all have at different moments in our lives. And I'm not trying to expound and say that it's only these universal desires and that's it. But I think that having a framework is a helpful kind of launching point for discussing desire, because we often don't know where to begin. I don't know about you. I don't know what comes up for you when you hear the word desire. It often gets eroticized and associated with a kind of pressure to know what you want or to hide what you want, whatever it is. Like we can be vague and not know how to begin a conversation about it.
Yeah, no, well, in your book, I mean, you got, after all, 12 case studies, and about half of them involve sex or procreation pretty directly. But then again, the others don't. I mean, because there's a lot of other ways in which desires come into play. So that makes a lot of sense to me. The PR material also said the new generation of therapy. So I also thought I should maybe open by framing things around that, if there's something significant we should be drawing into the conversation here.
Yes, I mean, I think that therapy does well when it's a little bit startling and provocative. And that does not mean being wildly unboundary or unprofessional, but it does mean kind of agitating slightly, like being a little bit restless with the process as a therapist. I think therapy can be too slow going, and it's actually helpful to kind of get a move on and sometimes say the difficult thing as a therapist to a client, even if it's not comfortable to hear. I think.
No, I like that, getting a move on. I mean, I'm a poet by background for a number of years, and you know, Emily Dickinson, for instance, or William Blake, there's poets who just deliver a lot and they can do it rather quickly. And it's utterly startling what they're unpacking for you. And, I like that pace. That works for me. Hopefully it works for your clients.
Well, I mean, and also sometimes just being bold and saying the thing that cannot be said easily anywhere else. And there is something about the emotional kind of lack of censorship in therapy that I think can be invigorating and creative.
Sure. So speaking of that kind of innovative spirit that I'm catching wind of here, so you have your own glossary of terms in the back of the book that intrigued me. I'd once crowdsourced a book mocking a business lexicon called Blah, 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 and I love Flaubert's dictionary making fun of the bourgeoisie, and of course there's Ambrose Bierce's Devil's Dictionary, which is one of my all-time favorite books. So what's a favorite term for you from your own glossary?
Oh, I think superiority is probably.
Oh my God, that's the one. That's the one I would have chosen as my favorite.
Is it? I like that. I mean, I just live and breathe it every day, and I needed to find a term in a grandiose and insecure way. Just the whole process of even coming up with the word with a friend of mine, to describe that incredibly uneasy, constant tension between a kind of big self-belief and a staggering self-doubt. Is that relatable?
That's so good. That's just amazing way to
and
put it.
I mean, I think there's something about ego that we really struggled to admit to. Like, where are the people who are going to actually just be honest about the fact that of course they have ego injuries and raging ego issues. I feel like it should be talked about more.
Well, is that one way of us getting into the question of sacred monsters?
Sure.
Yeah.
Interesting. So, good link.
Yeah. So you offered that as the title for the episode, and I want to make sure we don't fail to get there in our limited time. So talk to me about the importance of sacred monsters and what constitutes. You can take the question any place you want. Examples of it by individuals or certain characteristics you've seen, patterns. I don't care. You run with it.
I talk about sacred monsters in this book, and it's actually the name of the book I'm writing now. And it was very much the kind of backdrop while I was writing Tell Me What You Want. And it's really our enthrallment with the wrong people, with the dangerous people, with the kind of taboo attachment. And I think that we are incredibly conflicted at different moments in life about wanting what we're not supposed to want. And then we have a way of holding on to the kind of bad person or the wrong person or the love story that went wrong.
And yeah, go ahead. Yeah, keep going.
It's really about our own kind of disavowed shadow side, but also our discomfort, but intrigue about danger and self-destruction and death and darkness. And I think I really like the dark side. I really think that it's kind of rich and worthwhile to just go to the doom and the despair and give up hope about certain things and whatever the kind of inappropriate feeling might be, whatever the transgressive desire might be, just to kind of start with the wrong list and go from there.
Sure. Well, just last night on PBS here in the States, I was watching a very peculiar hour Dylan program, and I'm pretty sure he called it The Shadow Kingdom, where
Love
he was
it.
Taking 14 of his songs and kind of reinterpreting them as his want. So getting to your book, speaking of this kind of desire for darkness that we don't always acknowledge in ourselves, makes me think of the penultimate chapter of the book, where you have a woman named Alice who was for a long time involved with a abusive French film director, a guy named
yes.
Rafa. She says, you know, I find basically darkness more authentic, more real than, you know, goodness. It does
her
more
health.
For her. Yeah.
Well, and she is someone who has made all of the right decisions technically, behaviorally, and she's made the sensible, healthy, secure, safe choices. And health is incredibly boring at moments. And I think there can be a kind of wish for healing and reparation and flourishing. And then there can also be a real grief for the pain that you don't have, or the kind of the torture. Like, there can be this sense of boredom that is almost worse than actually suffering.
Yeah, well, I guess my favorite Beatle was always John Lennon. He's the one who said, one thing you can't hide is when you're crippled inside. And, you know, I don't love every John Lennon song the same level, but I'm not bored by pretty much any of them.
Right.
There's always some friction going on in him that's just a little bit stronger than in the other Beatles, shall we say. At least to my taste.
Right.
So, So we both love superiority. I find that interesting. The 12 case studies, was there a particular meaning to the order in which they're presented? I was trying to deduce one and wasn't sure.
I actually just wanted to offer a range of dynamic, vibrant stories about different people from different walks of life and the kind of recurring themes that come up. And there are certain struggles that play out in so many different cultures and circumstances, like the desire for attention and the shame we feel for being straightforward about that. I mean, adults do not like to admit that they want attention, but everyone wants attention, even if we also push it away and feel embarrassed by it. And
I would agree. I mean, I many years ago, I remember I was reading in a article, and it was about people who have avoidant tendencies, and it was describing that as a child you want your mom to run after you even if you're running away and come fetch you and bring you back and hug you. And my mom admitted to me that she'd rather clean the house than play with her kids. And so if I got that longing in me someplace, it's probably because it didn't quite get satisfied.
That's very honest and not totally comfortable, I imagine.
No, it's not. But it is what it is, and I'm prepared to accept it for its reality.
Yeah, but I think you're brave to say it, and also, I mean, those agonies have fascinating ways of then just creeping up and playing out in different iterations. I don't know if you've reenacted the dynamic as many times as I have with my with my patterns, but like the source of hurt can just play out in so many different versions of relationships.
Oh, absolutely. No, I think it's the patterns, and even when you're conscious of them, the grip they can have on you.
Yeah.
Because you have these moments of truth or moments of possibility, and sometimes you seize them or you don't, or you half seize them or they slip out of your hands. And then I go back and I try to understand why.
Right. And I think that's where the sacred monster comes in, because there is something utterly worthwhile and meaningful feeling about that core conflict. We don't really want to give up the conflict. And I think conflict is something worth embracing and not kind of not being afraid of, because conflict is the point of any plot, any story. And I think that tension becomes the kind of unofficial plot of our lives, where we are working out some wound and thinking we can fix it and get it right in some different format. And it's kind of the battle that we keep on fighting.
Yeah, no, that's basically where you find the pulse of life. I mean, what's the famous comment from the Orson Welles script for Third Man, the movie set in Vienna? You know, the Italians have had all of this conflict and great art, and he's being facetious, and the Swiss have had calm and neutrality, and all it's given them is a cuckoo clock.
It is synchronicity that you're saying that, because I actually had that exact conversation earlier today.
Well, between superiority and then Orson Welles and cuckoo clocks, maybe we're going to have to meet off air at some point in London. Who knows?
Yeah, I mean, and also you seem less surprised by the idea that we all have sacred monsters than some people. Where I mean, I'm often asked as a therapist, like, why do I keep picking the wrong person? Why do I go for such jerks? Like, why do I only want the person who rejects me and deprives me? You seem accepting of our wish for struggle.
Families have a lot going on. Let Ollie help manage the mental load with new cognitive health supplements for everyone 4 and up, like delicious Ollie Focus Pops or Ollie Mellow Pops for kids. And for parents, try 3 new Brainy Chews to help you focus, chill out, or get energized. Find these cognitive health buddies for the whole fam at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
Yeah, no, I just think it's very real and too often unacknowledged and avoided to the extent that people can get away with it. Of the 12 case studies, is there one that you particularly want to talk about? Because I've got about 5 minutes left and I want to make sure I don't deprive you of that opportunity.
Well, so I would like to talk about wanting what we shouldn't, that actually we like transgressing and we like negotiating the rules around what we're supposed to want. We want to be good. We also want to be not good. We are kind of always looking at these different conflicts unofficially in ourselves and in other people. And I think that we get drawn into the half good, half bad friend or boss or whatever the relationship is in your life. But we like being torn about whether we can get through to people, change people, and sort out this dilemma. And actually, I don't think that the contradictions need to be fixed or can be fixed. And I think one of the messages that sounds incredibly bleak but is actually consoling is that it's great to give up hope and to kind of recognize that you cannot have something that you want.
Somehow, something Gertrude Stein's coming to my mind because of her quote, "There is no answer. There's never going to be an answer. That's the answer."
I like it. Yeah. And toxic positivity.
Yeah. It's a liberating. So I'm interested, you know, because you admit that as a therapist, you know, you kind of want the kettle to boil a little bit and move things along and dare to be bold. And yet I can imagine in a lot of cases, you know, that can be shocking to a client who comes wanting to be healed or improved or help make progress, and yet they're also afraid of it. So there must be a lot of tension as to how you play your role at any given time as a therapist.
I think it's really important to try to adjust to the particulars of any individual. And people want to actually be recognized as idiosyncratic and remarkable anyway. And I think there is something about the therapeutic process that really honors that. So it's never one size fits all. And it's very annoying to people usually if they're told that it's just a kind of predictable pattern entirely in their textbook. But at the same time, I think that disruption and sometimes even a crisis can be a catalyst for making change.
Oh, absolutely. I think that's how you handle those moments of crisis is biggest chances for growth and probably the biggest test that you're going to go through and hopefully one doesn't flunk it. I mean, I've certainly faced my own crises and tried to learn from them and grow and take them on as best I could. So,
but I think it's also about courage and kind of leaning into the challenge of it because it's very awkward and difficult to really be honest in a conversation. And even in therapy, like we hide seek and pretend and play games. And it goes both ways. And therapists hide too. And actually kind of revealing what's really going on in the here and now on either side is so difficult. And it's really freeing and kind of exciting to do.
But I've come back more and more in life into thinking about the importance of the character or characteristic of having or displaying courage. There's those wonderful lyrics in The Wizard of Oz where the cowardly lion sings about what puts the hot in Hottentot? Courage.
I like it. I like it. But it's also, I've just felt so kind of deceived by therapists myself where I have sensed that they have, one in particular, I really felt her dislike of me and maybe I felt my own dislike of her. But we never really got there. And I actually think it would have been helpful if she could say something to me about what she felt. And she just wouldn't say anything. She wouldn't kind of admit that she struggled to work with me or found me difficult. I feel like we hold back and then act out in different ways. So actually looking at our aggression is a big part of looking at what it is we seek.
Well, yeah, then you'd be in the land of passive aggressiveness without acknowledging it, which means you'd be right home here in Minnesota where we've got Minnesota Nice Syndrome. Yeah. So I got to ask you one more question before we get to the close here. So I had once for Cosmo magazine, of all things, facially coded the royal wedding of Harry and Meghan. And right. I know he was just in court recently trying to take on what he would consider very much not sacred monsters, which is the tabloid press in England.
Right.
So he had his memoir not long ago. It's sold, buckets loads. Obviously, there's a whole lot going on with Harry and his family. As a therapist, any comments, observations about the travails of Harry?
I feel like poor Harry has just been, he's just been eviscerated for emotional displays. And it's quite savage. And at the same time, sure, he says too much. He doesn't know how to not keep talking or not keep seeking. So he probably has too many different voices in his therapy chorus of people who help him and support him. And he is working on himself and he's so attacked. I find it very upsetting to witness. the lack of empathy for him and the energetic hatred of her.
Yeah, no, I found it very displeasing. As a facial coder, I could not fail to notice the disgust and contempt expressions of members of the royal, maybe not the inner royal family, but certainly the larger entourage or social grouping. And yes. I've been horrified by what's going on. I find his brother comparably boring. And I do commend Harry for his avid seeking, his hunger for getting to some better place. I find it admirable, actually.
Absolutely. I mean, Harry is the ram with horns and William is the sheep who follows rules, even if he's at the top. He's so obedient.
Yeah, no, there's a lot of sheep involved there. So we're going to have to leave it there, but I could have happily gone on for an hour, believe me. So this has been Charlotte Fox Weber. She is my guest on the 137th episode of Dan Hill's EQ Spotlight. The topic today are love and hate of sacred monsters. Charlotte's book is called Tell Me What You Want, A Therapist and Her Clients Explore Our 12 Deepest Desires. If you've enjoyed today's show, of course, give it a rating or review on iTunes. Much appreciated. Finally, I'd like to conclude every episode with an epigram that I hope is appropriate. In this case, I couldn't resist taking one from Johnny Carson, of all people, who said, "In Hollywood, if you don't have a shrink, people think you're crazy." Until next time, take care and be well.